Support for The Best of Our Knowledge comes from the College of St. Rose in Albany, offering master's and certificate programs for working adults looking to advance or change their careers. Easily accessible to downtown and state offices, the College of St. Rose has served the Capital District since 1920. strose.edu/grad programs for applications.
This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Well, we've been hearing about the problem of rising student debt for so long that some graduates have been using it as a badge of honor. A lot of that debt is generated by for-profit colleges, schools that continue to attract a growing number of students.
We really only understood them as being duped, you know, being prey, or as being really savvy consumers.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the rise of for-profit colleges and how inequality, both financial and academic, is fueling that rise. We'll also spend an academic minute seeing if you should go solar. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. According to Brookings, the volume of outstanding college student debt has tripled over the past 10 years, reaching more than $1 trillion. And students attending for-profit colleges are responsible for over one-third of that debt. To find out about the rise and, in a few cases, the fall of these colleges, I spoke to Tressie McMillan Cottom, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Virginia Commonwealth University and the author of the new book, Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. I was interested in why McMillan Cottom took on this topic, so I asked why. What made you think I got to write a book about this?
Oh, goodness. That's a great question, because I actually really resisted for a long time writing about this topic at all, precisely because of how I did come to know about it, Bob. So before going to graduate school and becoming, you know, by most measures, a very traditional academic, I had worked in two for-profit colleges in North Carolina. I worked at one that in the book I call the beauty school and the other that I call the technical school. And my experiences in the for-profit college sector really did shape how I understood why people were choosing these institutions. I had a sort of different experience of the millions of people who were going into for-profit colleges. Once I did become an academic and a researcher, I was a little disappointed and, frankly, a little concerned about how we were talking about people who were enrolled in for-profit colleges. We really only understood them as being duped, you know, being prey, or as being really savvy consumers. And for me, the truth was somewhere in the middle. And in fact, what I had come to know about these students and my time working with them was that when we understood how complex their choices and their options were, we really had a much more complicated but important story about how for-profit colleges affect all of us. So that's why I ended up writing the book.
See, I think of these colleges because, well, I'm old, as those correspondence schools used to see on the back of a matchbook cover.
Right.
They've certainly come a long way from that, though, haven't they?
Just a smidge, to say the least, yes, Bob. For the record, I remember those too, right? Learn how to draw an animal, and then they also had, like, some technical correspondence courses, et cetera. In many ways, there is still a segment of for-profit schools that are like those old correspondence schools. They do things like the school that I worked for, train people how to be a cosmetologist or auto mechanic. But one of the things that's happened, starting around the mid-1990s and through the early 2000s, was that the landscape of for-profit colleges really did change a lot. The new sort of model in for-profit colleges were the ones that now have the ads everywhere, right? On public transportation, television, radio, and your newspaper, with names like Strayer, DeVry, the University of Phoenix. These are shareholder corporations, meaning they operate very much like any other publicly traded company that you can buy stock in, right? That sells and that raises money by selling shares of the company. By becoming a shareholder company, for-profit colleges' relationship with profit really changed. And because of that, their relationship to students changed. When you have to generate profit quarter over quarter to keep your shareholders happy, you have to grow really, really fast. And growing really, really fast, you've got to come up with a really efficient way to enroll hundreds of thousands of new students constantly while also keeping costs very low. And that has set up some of the sort of the worst abuses, I think, and excesses in the for-profit college sector. But it is true that for all for-profits, even the ones that are more like those old correspondence schools, what I argue is we still kind of have a problem because they serve so many people who don't have any other options. And that's a social problem for all of us.
Is it lack of options because of educational background or economic background?
Both. So what we have mostly understood it as up in, you know, until recently, and hopefully, you know, I contribute to the conversation that would change that, is that mostly we understood that people were going to for-profit colleges because they had come out of a vastly unequal K-12 system. And that is absolutely true, and I point that out in the book. We have produced millions of new high school graduates, but at the expense of preparing everybody equally. Equally well, right, to make the sort of choices about higher education that we assume everyone is able to make. But at the same time that that has happened, that's part of the story, but it's not the only part of the story. And when we allow that to be the only part of the story, what we end up doing is blaming people for the choices that they make, right? If you go to a bad school and take out bad debt, it's because you're a bad person and you made bad choices. But that's because we don't understand that other part, the economic part. And the economic part is this. There is now increasingly very few options for people to become suitably trained for our labor market without going to post-secondary higher education. So at the same time, K-12 has become even more unequal and produced students who have more aspirations than they have the preparation for college. We have said almost the only path to a good job in our economy is to have some college education. And when you set up those two dynamics, we're sort of on a crash course for for-profit colleges to serve millions of people who really don't have any other practical choice if they want good quality work.
What I find difficult to understand is how people like that in that situation could be drawn to these colleges where community colleges are almost everywhere.
Well, I think the first thing is for us to maybe realize that community colleges actually aren't everywhere, right? So I cite this idea and this concept in the book called education deserts. And for those of us who especially live on the two coasts or live in pretty close proximity to a major urban area, it's really hard to imagine. But we know empirically that there are huge parts of the country where there actually isn't an accessible, local, affordable public college education, not easily accessible. Now, some of that is about where people live. Some of that is about truly economically depressed areas that have not been able to support, you know, the investment in public higher education. So there are some places where that really isn't an option. But even in the places, so in the book, for example, I focus on Atlanta, where I say, this is a city where people have every option available to them. They have so many public higher education choices. Why would they choose the for-profit college? And that it does get a little bit more complicated, and a couple of things are why they choose them. The one reason that is true for almost everybody in for-profit colleges, whether they are poor or middle class, male or female, African American, white, Hispanic, is that people have so little time. They have so little time. When you are trying to fit credentialing or college around a very complicated life of maintaining your job, caring for family, all of those other responsibilities that we have, you really need to get enrolled in school quickly and finish quickly. And that's something that for-profit colleges really specialize in. That for lots of reasons, the local community college really can't compete on those grounds. It takes a lot of money, and really shifting the money from teaching to marketing to enroll people as fast as they kind of need to be enrolled.
You do talk about how the for-profit schools getting through the financials seems to be a lot quicker and easier.
Yes, yes. You can walk the, you know, when you hear those numbers call, you know, such and such a day and change your life. Well, that phone call, I did that to, you know, change my life at 9 different schools to get a sense of what the process was for lots of students. From phone call to being completely enrolled, on average, could take you 3 to 4 days at a for-profit college. 3 to 4 days, as opposed to 6 to 14 weeks, right, at the local community college, as opposed to 6 months in advance at a traditional not-for-profit four-year college even. I mean, you're talking days as compared with weeks, and that matters for lots of people.
Hmm. Do these degrees that people eventually can get at the for-profit colleges, I mean, are they going to get people jobs?
So far, the data are in on that, and not really is the answer.
Okay.
We're always, you know, keeping an eye on that. But right now, here's the best case scenario for the typical. That's not to say that this couldn't be different for a few individuals. But for the typical for-profit college student, first of all, they're more likely to drop out than they are to finish. But even if they do finish, what we are finding is that those with a credential from a for-profit college are more likely to be unemployed than a student at a traditional not-for-profit. And when they are unemployed, they're unemployed for longer. And then when they are employed, they earn less. So I say that if this is what we assume the best case scenario is, we're spending billions of dollars of public money for an educational process that doesn't look like it transforms people's lives for the good.
Still to come, our conversation with Tressie McMillan Cottom continues with a look at one of the most publicized for-profit college failures, ITT Tech. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Tressie McMillan Cottom, author of the book Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. Last year, ITT Tech, one of the biggest or at least most publicized for-profit colleges, had to shut down. I asked how this could happen and is it a danger for other for-profit schools?
I mean, I think it's always a danger. So I think what happened broadly were a few things. To be fair, ITT Tech was probably of all the shareholder for-profit colleges had some of the most, I think it's fair to say, aggressive marketing practices, and it had a very high rate of growth over the last 10 years. And I think because of the high rate of growth and how quickly they had to enroll students to, again, keep up with the incentives for them to create more profit, it put them in a position to enroll students who could not complete or were not able to repay their student loans. So they got into a lot of trouble with student loan defaults and poor job placement statistics and high dropout rates. Because of how we regulate for-profit colleges, those are the three areas where they are most vulnerable to being sued, and that's what we saw. We saw really what the problem with ITT Tech is that the cost of litigation for all of the regulatory abuses just really outstripped their ability to pay.
Well, you said the magic word there, and I'm going to stop you because you said regulation.
Yes.
Given our new administration, are some of those regulations going to go away?
Yes. I take this administration at its word. I take them both literally and seriously to critique one of the lines that came out of the election. I think their appointment of Betsy DeVos, whose focus, mind you, is mostly on K-12, but as the head of the Department of Education, is also responsible for higher education policy. And her position on public education, that it needs more competition from the private sector, well, that's exactly what for-profit colleges are. They are thought of, especially by those on the political right, as direct competition to public higher education. So if she believes in that, I assume she believes in increasing opportunity for those institutions. Additionally, Jerry Falwell Jr., President Trump has nominated him as his advisor on higher education policy. And again, Jerry Falwell Jr. has a long history of supporting the idea of private sector market education as direct competition to public higher education. So I believe them when they say they want to make it easier for those entities to operate. So I suspect the very first, the first 100 days of this presidency has already been about rolling back regulations just about every sector. I suspect we'll see the same thing happen in higher education.
A concept, you say, is that these colleges turn inequality into profit. How do they do that?
For-profit colleges, because they do not do any of the other stuff that we associate with college, right? These aren't public campuses, so you can't go up there, you know, give or take a few of the larger for-profits in certain places. You don't just go up as a public citizen, for example, and rent a space at the local for-profit college. It's not part of the community. Right. One of the reasons why it's not is because they understand that they are only there to deliver the credential. Right. They don't offer, they don't raise revenue through any other means. Almost all of their revenue comes from tuition, which almost entirely comes from the federal student aid program. Well, that's only a viable business model if we could keep producing graduates from unequal K-12 higher education who cannot secure jobs that will provide them on-the-job training for labor market entry and promotion. Well, those are two processes for inequality. Those are processes that are more true for rural workers, for women, especially women of color, because of a history of how race and class and gender has shaped who has access to good education and good jobs. And for-profit colleges then are only a viable business plan if those things continue. And the people that are most valuable to for-profit colleges as prospective students are those who can borrow the most from the federal student aid system. Those who can borrow the most are usually those that have the highest amount of economic need. That's why we see so many single mothers and women in the for-profit college sector. So for-profit colleges, because they don't serve any other community or public need, public good need, and because they only provide a credential and they only work if we keep producing people from unequal K-12 schools who don't have access to good jobs by any other means, only generate profit if we keep these patterns of inequality. Inequality is very profitable for the for-profit college sector.
Well, it's not like the not-for-profits are getting any cheaper, though, are they?
No, but they're still cheaper than for-profit, so let's start there, you know, on average. And cheaper means that if the issue was about who was most expensive and who was cheaper, what we should see is that those with the highest amount of student loan debt would be the most likely to default on their student loans, for example. Instead, what we see, especially among those students who have student loan debt because they attended a for-profit college, is we find that even those with very small student loan debt, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, are defaulting on their student loans. They're having problems even repaying small student loans. So that suggests that it isn't just about fixing the high cost of tuition, which I'm all in favor of, by the way. It suggests that there are people for whom they are already so poor when they start at for-profit colleges and have such poor economic prospects that even a small debt for education is far too much for them to take on. Again, that's about as much about inequality as it is about the total tuition cost.
Finally, I'd like you to talk about the group you're in called SWAG. What's that all about?
So I had the opportunity to spend some time with a group of women who were enrolled in online for-profit graduate programs. And now this is interesting for a few reasons. To go back to the start of our conversation, we really had always understood that people choose for-profit colleges because they kind of don't know any better. Right? The economic term for that, economists call it being a low information consumer, which is a nice way of saying you didn't know better. So the students in SWAG were interesting because so many, all of them, because they were in graduate programs, had a bachelor's degree. So kind of by definition, they couldn't be totally low information. And most of them had bachelor's degrees from traditional colleges and universities. So they had some experience in a not-for-profit college setting. So to understand why they chose a for-profit college, I thought was super interesting because they sort of refute all of our natural assumptions about people who choose for-profit colleges. And I spent time with these women. I think a couple of things came out about their choices. One is this idea of the education gospel, as I talk about in the book. We believe so much that education is transformative that we don't even have a language for the idea of bad education. There's no such thing as bad education. All education is good. And while the women in SWAG had learned precisely that there was no such thing as a bad education choice, because they believed so much in the American ideology of good all education is good, they were willing to take on student loans debt in excess of $130,000 to get a graduate degree from online for-profit colleges. They made sense of that debt in some really interesting ways, and I think one of the most interesting is that they didn't think of their high student loan debt as a problem. They thought of it as prestige, as evidence that they had worked hard for their education, that they had incurred a serious debt meant that they were serious about their education. So what has happened when we have expanded access to more loans instead of grants while telling people that they need to get all the education they can possibly find and are willing to pay for? Is that the only thing they're left to do to make sense of high loan debt and some pretty, you know, negative experiences in these programs was that the debt must be good. As one student told me, if it wasn't good, they wouldn't have let me borrow it. And I think she had a point.
Well, is it going to get better?
I have to think that things get better or else I wouldn't be able to do this work. So I think the potential is always there for things to get better. I do think in the short term, again, revisiting our political moment, I think in the short term it's going to get harder. But I think there is some hope. I think a lot of people are starting to organize around the idea of debt in higher education. A lot of that came out of this last election. I think as people continue to sort of understand how student loan debt is a barometer for all of these other problems, and especially if we could develop a language about education both being good but also having some problem areas, that as we develop that language, I think that we can make better choices, political choices, because I think in the end this is about the hard political choices we have to make.
Again, the name of Tressie McMillan Cottom's new book is Lower Ed, The Troubling Rise of For-Profit Colleges in the New Economy. It's published by the New Press.
Is the data available on your home enough to make you go solar? Well, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do we make our homes more efficient? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Robert Brekka, professor in the Renewable and Clean Energy Program at the University of Dayton, discusses why low energy living doesn't have to be uncomfortable.
Our homes use 20% of the energy in the country and account for about a quarter of all carbon dioxide emissions. Becoming more efficient in how we use energy at home is not only a personal issue, but an active area of research. And the personal and professional can be mixed nicely. Dreaded monthly utility bills actually contain enough information for researchers to get a really good start on sorting through lots of data on homes around the country and figuring out which could use the most upgrades or need behavioral changes. Take the electric and gas bills of a home for a couple of years, together with the average temperature of each month, and we can get a lot of information about that house's insulation, hot water consumption, air conditioning use, and more. How do we get people to act on our research? Homeowners are notoriously short-sighted and don't tend to make changes unless they will pay off quickly. We demand a much higher return on our home energy investments than we would ever receive from the bank. Research has found small victories. The realization that you've saved more than your neighbor tends to be a great motivating force. Even getting a bit of positive reinforcement is enough to spur more action. But low-energy living does not mean uncomfortable living. I found this out myself several years ago when we built a straw bale house with solar energy for hot water and electricity. Unintentionally, a personal choice became a great teaching tool and a real-life application of reducing energy use by 80% compared to average houses. And now my town has several different super energy efficient houses, which students can use as part of their own research.
That was Robert Brekka of the University of Dayton. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. Thank you. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.